Welcome to Speak Up, the official podcast of Speech Pathology Australia. We bring you insightful conversations with leading professionals about key issues and innovations in speech pathology, all in a concise format that's perfect for your busy schedule. We aim to inform, inspire, and also engage. We love hearing from you, so please join the conversation on our social media platforms or email us with your thoughts and questions. And please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Your support helps us grow and inform, inspire and engage others. Now, let's embark on today's conversation. Hi, and welcome to Speak Up. This is Nadia, and today I'm joining you from the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung and Boonwurrung peoples of the Eastern Kulin Nation. Today, we are having a conversation with Professor Andrew Whitehouse. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for being here.
G'day, Nadia. What a thrill.
We're really excited to have a conversation with you today because you're going to be doing one of the keynote presentations at the Spark Conference later this year.
I am, and what an absolute pleasure it will be to doing that. I did start out my professional life as a speechy, and there is a small grain of kind of exhilaration that speechies haven't disowned me, so I'm really excited.
Oh, fabulous. Look, I'm very aware that you are somebody that wears about three dozen hats at any one time. So I would love to have a bit of a chat about some of the other roles that you do before we talk about the things that you'll be talking about at the SPAR conference. And I should just note for people that are listening, Professor Andrew Whitehouse will be talking on Tuesday, the 28th of May. And the conference is in Borloo, Perth, which is from Monday, the 27th to Wednesday, the 29th of May at the Perth Convention Centre. Andrew, one of the other things that you do, apart from all of this work that you're going to be doing with us, is that you've been working on the Inklings project, which I would really love to hear a little bit more about.
Oh, absolutely. And before I start, I'll acknowledge that I'm on traditional lands, so the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, acknowledge elders past and present. So it's a really pleasure to work and to partner with Aboriginal people on our lands. Look, the Inklings project, fantastic project. Mm-hmm. And this really comes back to when I practiced as a speechy. So I practiced for about 2 or 3 years right out from graduation. And I remember just vividly, autism was a really new condition at that time. And we really only started diagnosing autism in any great numbers towards the late 90s and early noughties. And so autism was still quite rare when I was early practicing. And it would still be quite commonly the case that I would get to the age of, kids would get to the age of sort of 5 or 6 and often would be nonverbal or not really using verbal language as their primary mode of communication. I would be the first person who they would be speaking to. And when you dig deep down, you started to understand pretty clearly that actually that's a system failure rather than a failure of any other aspect. And the system failure is that we didn't have systems in place that can identify little bubs developing differently and provide support and accept referrals for kids that young. Mm-hmm. And so the Inklings program is essentially our way of seeking to try and change systems to embrace kids and families very young. The Inklings program is a program for 6 to 18 month olds who are showing early social communication delays. It's not about autism in any way, shape or form. It's about little babies who are showing early social communication delays or differences. Mm-hmm. And we have a really good understanding now that of which babies at that age might require some additional support. And so we've gone through a really rigorous research process, and this is something that I've really tried to instill a little bit more into the speech path practice, which is that we should expect and only accept the same levels of rigor in terms of scientific rigor as we do in other areas of health and medicine. So we developed the program. It's been going through a big community consultation with autistic adults, one clinical trial, a second clinical trial, found nice replicated evidence all the way along, and it's now being implemented. So what does that look like? That's implementing within Western Australia and then soon South Australia, whereas there's a government funding envelope for little babies who are 6 to 18 months who are developing differently to receive this intervention approach, which is all about changing the environment around the baby to meet the needs of the baby rather than necessarily changing the baby. So it's super exciting. It's really going from idea all the way through to implementation, which for people like me is the ultimate.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And amazing that you've been able to include the autistic community in that as well. I think that'll really
Oh, it's a key
hopefully
part of
improve
it,
it.
actually. And
Yeah.
so this program really has its origins about 10 to 15 years ago, where the idea of community involvement wasn't as strong as it is now, but we sought to
Yeah.
be at the leading edge of that, where we ensured that just the therapy philosophy, it's not necessarily your more traditional behaviorist type approaches. It's quite the opposite. It's about changing the environment to meet the needs of the baby, a quite social model of
Yeah.
disability approach. And then at every step, we've really involved the autistic community. Is this meeting needs? Is the aim there? Is these techniques align with neurodivergent communities' views and expectations? We've been very pleased all the way along to follow that process.
Yeah, sounds incredible. You're also involved in the Autism CRC, and I saw that quite recently they were involved in the publication of some new diagnostic guidelines that were a review of, I think it was 2018 when the first ones came out. Can you tell us a bit about that as well?
Yeah, totally. And look, I'm going to try and jazz up guidelines to make them sound
I
exciting because they are
was
super
excited by them.
important. They are so super important, but often they can seem a little dull and dreary. Look, I started in the area of working with guidelines probably about 6 or 7 years ago. And guidelines are so important in other areas of health and medicine. I'm lucky to work at an institute, Telethon Kids Institute, that it has all areas of health and medicine, and I'm very influenced by the standards of rigor that are just de rigueur in those areas of health and medicine. And there is no reason, in fact, there's an absolute expectation that we should have that in our area as well. And so in the area of autism, that's perhaps been exaggerated, the lack of evidence and clinical guidelines in this area. And there are lots of reasons for that. I'm more than happy to go into it. But the upshot is that we haven't had the same level of evidence for the therapy and diagnostic practices that we should have. So in say about 2016, we developed through the Autism CRC, we developed the first national guidelines for how you diagnose autism. As we know, diagnosis for autism differed quite
Yeah.
markedly between states, but even in the same state, you'd have the health department use one kind of approach, and then these kids meet the education system and maybe even require a new diagnosis. I mean, it's
Yeah.
total madness. The
Yeah.
kind of emotional and financial and just human cost of that is nuts. So we sought to really provide a standard way of providing diagnosis. It's a huge consultative as well as a scientific and research effort as well. So that the first guideline came out in 2018. And every 5 years, so that's endorsed by the sort of peak body in Australia for guidelines. It's the National Health and Medical Research Council, and it provides a very standard evidence-based way for how we can provide assessments that may end in a diagnosis of autism or might require further information. Every 5 years, the NHMRC makes you update these because, of course, evidence changes. And so that's just been completed, led by a broad group, led by David Trembath and an autistic researcher, Emma Goodall, as well. So it's been fantastically co-designed as well. The final thing, sort of before moving on, is to talk about there's another guideline that we produced in, oh, I think it was 2023. And this was around how we can provide evidence-based supports or what probably would most people know as therapies or interventions. Again, autism is an area that has a lot of therapies and interventions that perhaps don't have the same level of evidence that we would like as other areas of health medicine. It was really important for us to start to develop really clear guidance for clinicians about what does meet evidence and what doesn't. And so, again, through a huge consultative effort, autistic adults were involved all the way along. We developed that guideline, and that's now published out there. It's called the Supporting Autistic Children's Guideline, published by the Autism CRC, and that was published in 2023. And we're really proud of that piece of work too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's have a bit of a chat about the keynote. So your keynote talk is Creating Speech Pathology Impact, Seven Lessons from the Intersection of Science, Policy, and Clinical Practice. So when I was reading it over, I felt like it was a really timely conversation that we need to be having. I think particularly people that are working in the NDIS space and disability more generally, the review that happened at the end of the last year has
kind of made people feel a little bit overwhelmed about what's going on and what things are going to even be looking like in the next little while. And we just recently had some legislation that went through, I think at the end of March that was. And yeah, I think one of the most difficult things for a lot of people in those situations is that you do feel a lot of stress and overwhelm working with a population that can be a little bit more complex than potentially traditional speech pathology clients. But then also being able to take a moment and step back and engage in reflective practice and check in with what your values are and how to manage those sorts of situations is something that I think is really important for a lot of what we're doing. And yeah, I just wanted to have a bit of a conversation about if you had any thoughts and advice on all of these bits and pieces.
Oh, lots. And it'd be great to hear your views as well, because none of us, I mean, let's just acknowledge this, we're all muddling along. None of us really know what we're doing. But there is strength and wisdom in numbers here. So, I mean, first to talk about the NDIS. The NDIS is a truly remarkable reform. I'm so lucky to be asked to review systems all over the world for different governments. And I can truly say that the NDIS in its principles are fundamentally a step ahead of any other system in the world.
Yeah, great.
Currently, of course, it's having incredible difficulties due to some own goals, but due to some inherent, perhaps, challenges in the original design. Mm. But how that actually plays out at the clinical level, I mean, I'm often talking about how this affects at the family level, but in terms of clinicians, I mean, it really has created an additional challenge in the area of clinical practice. I think there's a couple of things there just to highlight on. Number one is that the activity-based funding model, where people are paid based on the hours spent with an individual, means that every hour that clinicians spend with families is accounting. And it makes it a far more transactional relationship with a child and a family than it does previously, whereas there was a therapeutic kind of relational aspect to the interaction. Now it's a transactional relationship where if I take 15 extra minutes walking the family to the from the therapy room to the waiting room and they're a bit teary, that 15 minutes is billed for. And under previous models, that of course didn't happen. And that makes it really does provide compromises for how we provide our clinical support as well, which I think produces considerable stress on clinicians and families. So I think that's just one thing I really wanted to highlight in the NDIS model. I don't know if you have any reflections on that.
Yeah, it really is something that does feel very different to what things felt like pre-NDIS, and there are positives and negatives within all of that. It's amazing that so many families and individuals are able to get the supports that they're able to get these days, which, you know, you either weren't able to or you weren't able to get a sufficient amount of what you needed pre-NDIS. Yeah. And so I think that's an incredible thing. But yeah, you're right there. I hadn't necessarily thought about it in terms of a transactional nature as much as I had thought about the idea that I think a lot of people are very worried about making sure that they are using everyone's money in a very productive and outcome driven way, and potentially that impacts on the clinical relationship as well.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And you're exactly right. The NDIS has been truly remarkable. My youngest daughter is a member of the deaf community, and it's transformed our lives, her life and our lives with it. It's just been absolutely amazing, and makes me a bit teary just to think about it. But you're exactly right. Speechies don't want to be shop fronts. I can't think of a single speechie I've spoken to who says, well, you know, this is why I get into the area. Mm. And to have to think about these things compromises even further the challenges. So, you know, when we're talking about careers, all careers and lives have professional lives have positives and negatives. Like, there's no career or pathway that has a million positives. If we're lucky, those positives offset the negatives. And so when in speechy land we're tired, we're in back-to-back clients, you know, we're dealing with really challenging human issues because we're dealing with humans, but if that is offset by impact, that at the end of the day we can sort of go, did okay, then it's a worthwhile bargain. I think some of the times with the challenges of the NDIS is that bargain sometimes doesn't feel like it is worth it. But how do we get out of the hurly-burly and get ourselves out of that kind of thought thinking? Well, look, again, I'm really so lucky to speak to many people in a kind of a mentoring role. And the first thing that we always talk about is that rocking chair. You know, if we're lucky, we're going to be 85, you know, one day, and we're going to be looking back over our professional life. And what would 85-year-old you say is a professional life well led? Hopefully we're all going to be there. And one time or another, we're going to be having that kind of conversation with ourselves. Was that professional life I've just led worth it, and why? And I think part of that is, you know, inevitably people sort of come back to, well, I want to make an impact. And so it's about defining what that impact is. And so for me, and perhaps having that huge privilege of speaking to so many people, I think impact means that someone else's life somewhere is slightly better because I lived. And I often think that that's probably what we're all boiling down to in speechy land, that someone somewhere, their life was slightly better because we lived. And, of course, that impact can be in many areas. It can be clinical. It can be, you know, you can make a very, very deep impact, but for a relatively small amount of people. Or it could be science and policy, where you have the potential to make really broad scale impact, but only an inch deep. And so it really needs to align with what your personal view of impact is at any one time of your professional life.
Yeah, and I think to pick up on what you were saying just there as well, one of the things that we will often have conversations with members about is the idea of some of that conflict or unrest, at least, can come up when you are in a situation where you're feeling conflicted, because you have to act against what your values are in that moment in time. And it can be really challenging if you have that feeling but don't necessarily have the ability to understand why that is. And so it's really useful to be able to be thinking about that bigger picture and saying, what would the 85% year old me think of this?
Totally. And I think I hear you in terms of that conflict that can happen when we're working in imperfect systems. And I'll talk a little about this in the keynote. We work in imperfect systems, but systems are absolutely critical. You know, we don't have systems, the world doesn't go. But when we work in imperfect systems, it's really, really challenging, particularly when that goes against your values. I think perhaps the other thing I'd say about impact is that we often think about impact that I have created a program, it's now been rolled out across X, Y, and Z. I have, you know, transformed a system in A, B, and C ways. Well, yeah, I guess that is impact. But one thing I wanted to go into in the keynote is that every moment of every day is actually your opportunity to make impact. And often in this area, your greatest impact actually won't be in the clinic room. It will be in the tea room with your colleagues. It will be in the waiting room when you're consoling families, or at least greeting them with a smile that makes them feel valued and understood. It will be in your mentoring roles with other people. And so what I would love to convey during this keynote is that impact is those big things that are sort of met with a triumphant kind of, you know, fist pump in the air and a marching band, you know, crashing cymbals around you. Those things are really important, and that's what we have to strive for. But in the vast majority of our cases, our biggest chance to make an impact is actually those everyday moments that nobody sees and often whoosh past us anonymously. Those are the moments where we get to truly change people's lives.
It's such a great point. I think every family that I've ever worked with over the years, the things that they have reflected back to me of saying, you know, you said this one time and that really stuck with me, and I will have no memory of that whatsoever. But that was something that was clearly very important to them at that point in time. And it's great to be able to think about those micro level actions that you're taking and how, like you said, how that impact can pull you out from there and move on.
I mean, completely. And there is a reframing that needs to happen when we're totally weighed down by a system, and we feel like this is not what I got into, because I now have to write three referrals to meet three different systems. You know, this is not why we're here. That's a reframing about what can we do in our day-to-day jobs that truly are actually changing these people's lives, and keep keep firing and shooting for those incredibly lofty goals while also being very comfortable that your greatest impact you'll have will be in those one-to-one moments when nobody's looking or nobody's watching, and they will truly change people's lives.
Yeah. Look, I think we've done a really nice job of talking about the creating impact when things are feeling a little bit stuck, particularly in that one-to-one kind of work that we are doing with other people. I guess the other side of that is that there can be some feelings of frustration that pop up in our career when we thought about making an impact in a more big picture kind of way, and the opportunities that we can kind of engineer for ourselves to be able to do that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would suggest that, again, this is about having flexibility in our beliefs. We go into our careers thinking that this is the path for me, and the clinical path to a certain extent holds a reasonably understandable clinical pathway, that if I do this, it will lead to this, it will lead to this, it will lead to that. And actually, it's when I'm at that, right at the end, that's when my impact will come.
Yeah.
I would really encourage people to think that actually the skills, experience, expertise, qualifications that speech pathology gives you and has a clinical career as one possible direction, and the impact you can make there is substantial. Some of that will require luck if you're keen to, you know, make those kind of big marching band type impacts. But as I said, that we can actually all make impact every day. But at some of it, actually, the impact that you can make is to be flexible in your schemas that you have, that actually clinical pathway is only one pathway. You can actually go sideways. You can think about research. You can think about policy. You can think about working for the association. You can do all of these types of things. And that, how can we remain flexible in our view of impact in terms of, is it big scale? Is it small scale? Is it deep? Is it shallow? And as well as the flexibility in terms of the particular pathways that they might take you. One thing that I often speak with clinicians about when they're sort of keen for a bit of a chat about, oh, I'm at a bit of a crossroads, is that, that you don't need to plan for your whole career right now. What it is planning for what, you know, what's right now. I mean, I talk with families about this in terms of their children, is that it's really overwhelming when you receive a diagnosis that is a lifelong diagnosis for your child, and you're going to be bombarded with all sorts of information, and you're going to be anxious the whole time. But what your job is to make good decisions based on the information that you have right now. And then the next time you do that as well. And then the next time you do that as well for the right now. And then before you know it, you've strung together a childhood with a whole lot of pretty decent decisions. And I think that's the same for our career, is that we can plan for the future, but we don't know what's happening in the future. So we need to make good decisions right now. So it's flexibility in your beliefs, and don't try and plan for the rest of your life, because you've only got what's in front of you right now.
Very good advice. One step at a time.
I think more broadly that one of the things that speech pathology provides you is a path to professional impact, perhaps that other professions don't have. Everyone is getting into this profession to help other people live a better life because you were there to support them. There is not a single person who's got into this profession for financial reasons, or if they did, that was a seriously bad decision. And there aren't other people who have got into this for, sort of widespread prestige and acclaim. It's all about that. And what I'm here to tell you is that the ability to communicate, the ability to relate to other people, goes to the very essence and core of our humanity. This profession has given me just the most privileged opportunity to interact with literally now thousands of families. And our shared humanity comes from our relationships, comes from our ability to communicate and convey feelings to each other. And I just think that's totally at the core of what we're seeking to do. So if we are truly here to create impact, you're in the right profession. It's about being flexible in how you want to create that impact and reframing it as to, what can I do in the here and now to make this person's life a little bit better because I was there?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And We have been on the podcast doing a bit of a series of speaking to life members of the association as well. And there's some, we've done enough of those now that there's some really consistent patterns that are coming out with everyone, which is that you aren't necessarily looking for new opportunities, but there are lots of opportunities that pop up naturalistically that are of things that potentially you weren't thinking that were within your wheelhouse. And that because speech pathology spends so much time setting us up as communication professionals, there are so many things that are open to us as a result of the background we have.
That there is. And I guess what I would also sort of say is that, our whole career is targeted towards families and, clients and patients and as it should be. But that communication, that sort of relationship is equally true for our colleagues as it is for our sort of interactions with the families that we see. Perhaps some of the sort of greatest personal moments of connection, belief, the things that I will be thinking about when I'm 85 have happened with my colleagues in the absence of any families, and I feel like they've made my life better, and I've hopefully contributed a little bit towards the same with them. And so I would also sort of direct that kind of feeling and ambition towards how we relate with each other.
Yeah, fabulous. Before we let you go today, do you have any take-home advice for everyone that's listening or anything else that you'd like people to know about before your keynote address in May?
I guess what I want to convey, that's a great question. I mean, what I'd like to convey is just how lucky we are and to provide some really tangible ways in which we can create impact. My life has, my professional life has been lucky enough to span small amount of clinical practice. I was pretty useless at that, if we're truth to be told, and science, policy, and probably everything in between.
Yeah.
And how we can use those sort of skills towards really creating tangible and different ways in we can make impact. I think more broadly, it's we have the mind and. Our mind and our bodies are the sort of greatest instruments that the world has ever known, and our education is more than 99.9% of anyone in world history. Ultimately, it comes down to us as individuals making the choice that we are going to imagine a better world, and we want to be part of making it that better world. And I hope to provide some tangible ways in which we can seek to do that as a profession.
That'd be wonderful. Looking forward to it very much. So you will be at the conference, which is running the 27th to the 29th of May. Your keynote is on Tuesday morning, and that is at the Perth Convention Centre. So we're very, Perth Convention and Exhibition Centre. Very excited to see you then.
Wait.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast and share with your colleagues and friends. You can also visit us at speechpathologyaustralia.org.au. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.